Happy birthday, Alan. Or belated, I guess.
Happy belated. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
I had a wonderful birthday last week. Yep.
Yeah, last week was your birthday, and I got to... Lisa was nice enough to reach out and invite me to come to your birthday dinner.
Mm-hmm.
Which, man, I really appreciate that. It's so nice for her to do that. But we had dinner at... Do you know how to pronounce it? Kaya?
I'm pretty sure it's Kaya. Mexico?
Kaya
Mexico? I always intend to ask the servers and never do, but it's C-A-L-L-E.
Right.
I think it's Kaya in Mexican Spanish, right?
I think so. I think that's how you would pronounce it in Mexican Spanish, but I don't actually know enough to feel confident about it. Anyway, it's like a fairly like long running Mexican, authentic Mexican restaurant in Edmonton. And they used to have a location that was sort of like downtown-ish. And they've had a food truck for a really long time, too.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to go to their other location, like, not all the time, but maybe once a year or something.
Mm-hmm.
And, man, they just have, like, really good, like, authentic Mexican food, like tacos and, like, good tacos and sopas. And they have, like, really great tostadas. Man, just all their stuff is, like, really good.
Yeah.
And yeah, they moved like a while ago and their 107th Ave location closed down, and I never actually like found out where their new location was. And so it was like a real treat because I got to go and find out where their new location is. And it's it's on the south side now, so closer to your place than it is to my place.
Yeah, quite close to me on Calgary Trail. It's in the old, I will forever think of that building as the Atlantic Trapping Gill.
Right.
From
the, which was the, like a maritime themed bar, I guess.
Yeah. Which was a thing like in the, whatever that most recent oil boom, whatever we call that in Alberta.
Right.
That was a type of bar and restaurant in Alberta, certainly in Edmonton and Fort McMurray.
And in Calgary, there was a Trapping Gill in Calgary as well that I went to.
Right?
And I don't know if I ever went to the one in Edmonton, or maybe I went there like once or something.
But yeah, it was kind of like you would go there to drink Alexander Keith's and listen to Celtic music. And
yeah, and then get talked into taking like a shot of Screech.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I was always kind of a tourist on that scene, but I know that it was born out of it's kind of anecdotal, but they would always say that more than half of the population of Newfoundland lived in Alberta during oil booms and stuff like that.
Oh my God, that's crazy.
I mean, that's not a statistic. That's just like
people
would say.
You already prefaced it, but it's just
or that
crazy
there,
to that, hear
there
that
were
that
more
like,
Newfoundlanders in Fort McMurray than in Newfoundland at any given time and that kind
of
thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's crazy.
But anyways, now it's Kaya.
Yeah. And the food was good and the company was great. Maybe a little bit later on, I have to ask you about your horror movie night. Did you go to, has that happened yet?
Yep.
Oh,
it
great.
Happened,
okay.
Yep.
Okay. Yeah, I want to ask you about that.
Okay.
But the absolute best part of having your birthday dinner there was they have this like crazy over the top, extravagant, like, servers come to the table and sing you happy birthday.
That's right. Yeah.
They have like a frame that's like decorated with like with the words happy birthday and a bunch of like metallic shiny balloons and stuff like painted on it.
Mm-hmm.
And they put the frame around, they put a sombrero on your head, and then they put the frame around your face so people can take pictures, and then they sing happy birthday. Oh my God, it was crazy. And they did that. There was another adult male there who was like, I don't know, probably in his 60s or something, and they also did it to him. Man, I was just like blown away that they would do that to adults, and I just thought it was so hilarious, and I videotaped the entire thing.
Oh, perfect. That's good.
Yeah.
Good to know. And it's funny because when we walked in, there were happy birthday signs plastered on the walls.
I
assumed it was for me.
For you, because it was your birthday.
But Lisa hadn't mentioned to Kaya that she was coming for a birthday party. And then, so we saw all these, and I was like, oh, I can't believe that they did all this for me. And then the happy birthday music started playing later on. And I was like, okay, here it comes. And they walked right by me to the table behind us and put the sombrero on some other guy. And I was like, oh, okay, I see how it
is. Oh my God, that's amazing. Man, that's even better than I thought. So much drama.
It's been a while since I've seen that kind of restaurant birthday thing. Like it was kind of like it was de rigueur.
It was de rigueur.
The kinds of places that my family went out for dinner when I was a little boy, like Kelsey's and Kelsey's, Montana's. The places that have the stuff on the walls and but yeah, I haven't seen it in a while.
And like usually that. Those places had their own version of happy birthday, because there was like some weird rumor that happy birthday was like really heavily like copyright protected or something.
I think, okay, I remember that era when people wouldn't sing happy birthday if they thought it was going to be recorded. But to me, that is the mid 2000s. Cause I remember I worked at a coffee house, like a cafe that did open mic nights. And they would do happy birthday, like they would get either the performer or the room to sing happy birthday to certain guests, but they would turn off the recording because they were like, I don't know if they were live streaming or they were releasing it as a podcast or whatever. But yeah, there was this situation where apparently the people who own the rights to the song were seeking out recordings of it and starting lawsuits. But I don't remember that being a thing in the 90s. Like in Montana's, they just brought out the big moose antlers and put them on your head and sang.
Just sang happy birthday.
Yeah. And it was just a normal, lovely thing.
Yeah. Well, for one thing, I know now that happy birthday has been released from its...
public copy.
Yeah. I don't know if it's officially public. Like, I don't know if it's officially public domain, but it's like, it's under a license where anyone can use it now.
It's like fair use or something. Like you can use fair it as long use, as
maybe
you're not.
Or something. Yeah. I'm not sure what it is, but I also think, or I'm pretty sure, I've read a few stories that say that like the, you know, like being sued for singing happy birthday was like mostly an urban legend.
Oh, is it right? Okay.
It's not. Yeah. And it's not actually mostly real. Like maybe in a couple very specific instances, like really big movies or something, like the actual legal rights holder was like, you know, made some kind of attempt to sue for damages or something. But like, I think it was like in very rare cases and it just kind of like got passed around and it became a meme. Yeah.
An urban legend.
Urban legend. Exactly. Welcome to Food Court. I'm Shale McDonald, and I'm here with my co-host, Alan Sutterby. How are you, Alan?
Really good. Thanks for asking.
We are two chefs in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. We love food, and we love to talk about it. So, Alan, do we have bits and pieces of follow-up?
Well, our last conversation was about chef horror movies, that also niche subcategory, sorry, subgenre of, is it a subgenre of food movies or a subgenre of horror movies?
Subgenre of horror movies, I would say.
Oh, okay.
Maybe, yeah. I rewatched The Menu a couple days ago too, by the way.
Oh, was that right? That's one of the horror movies in your 31 days of...
It wasn't supposed to be, but my sister hadn't seen it and she's been watching some of the movies with me and she wanted to watch it. So we watched it and I don't remember exactly what all my opinions were of it when we discussed it on the show, but I think watching it the second time, I enjoyed it more.
Is that right? Yeah,
I think so. Just because like, I think the first time I watched it, I don't know, like I was waiting to have my expectations met in certain ways or something. And then there was like, there's a lot of stuff in that movie that is not very well explained. Mm-hmm. And not that I think that everything in a movie needs to be explained to death, like quite the opposite, actually, honestly. But there's just so many, like, for that movie to sort of make sense, for it to be cohesive, mm-hmm. you know, like a dish, Alan.
Oh, I see.
For it to make sense, you really have to understand a lot of characters. Like, you have to understand the motivations of the chef. You have to understand the motivations of his crew, like Elsa, and mm-hmm. who's like the maitre d' or whatever.
Yep.
And then you also have to understand the motivations of most of the dining guests, and you also have to understand the reasons why they are like the ones that got invited to be killed as a menu or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so there's just a lot of exposition that has to happen in a very short period of time. And I don't think the movie handles it all that well, you know, like it's just like, yeah, you don't really, I mean, you do get kind of what you need, but you don't really, I don't know. It's just like, things are moving so fast that like you're like, okay, yeah, okay, so these guys, there's something with the finances, and there's, you know, they did something bad with the finances, okay, I get it, okay. And then this guy, okay, like this guy cheated on his wife and he doesn't appreciate good food, okay, and Tyler is a foodie and that's bad because he's too I don't know, he thinks he knows everything or something. And, and you know,
so
like,
do you think that do you think that people in the food scene are able to kind of fill in those gaps in exposition just based on like social media tropes?
I do think so. Like I do think that the movie holds together and you do get the information that you need in that way, but it just feels like it's just so much and it seems to be rushing by so quickly. You know, like the movie kind of like never settles. The only time it like really settles down and there's actually any sort of like exploration of what's going on is when like the men are out getting hunted and the women get to sit down and have tea.
Right.
They actually kind of have a conversation with one of the cooks about it, right. About like why they're there and why, you know, why they think that they deserve to die or whatever. And there is a little bit of exploration of it there, which I appreciate. But yeah, there's just like the movie's moving in like 10 different directions. Like, I don't know. You never really get a satisfactory explanation for why his mom is there. I don't know. It's weird. Like,
right.
I kind of enjoyed it a little bit better the second time, I think, because the first time there was just, yeah, it was going in so many directions and I was like watching the food and then watching the plot and then trying to pick up all the character pieces. And it just like, there's a lot of moving pieces. And I think that like, since I didn't really know where it was going, it was like, felt like it was a lot to take in. And then it felt like a little bit ham-fisted because of that. But the second time watching it, I was like able to understand that that was going to be, you know, like the information that I was going to get. So I wasn't like expecting anything different. So I was sort of able to kind of like sit back and look for other maybe sort of more hidden clues about what's going on, or like interactions between characters that I maybe didn't notice the first time around or something like that. And so that was kind of cool.
The menu rewards multiple viewings. Is that what your assessment?
In my case, yeah. Yeah, I think it does. Like honestly, the first time that I watched it, so, you know, like one of the pivotal scenes is the Tyler's bullshit scene. Excuse my language. I'll have to bleep that out. And then, like, right after that scene happens, so it's, like, you know, harrowing for poor Tyler to have to cook under those circumstances, and he really undercooks some lamb. Then the chef tries it, and he's like, oh, this is terrible. And then they list it as one of the things on the menu, which I thought was hilarious at the time, and I thought it was hilarious the second time, too. Then the chef whispers something in his ear, and then he goes and takes his own life, like, right after that.
Yeah.
And the first time I watched it, I was like, man, that seems like, oh, like, what, you know, really? Was he that disturbed by having to cook in front of everyone that, like, the chef can just whisper something in his ear and suddenly he's like, oh, I can't go on, you know? Like, it seemed really I don't know what, manufactured or something to me.
And glib.
And glib, yeah. On a second viewing, though, like, I don't know, I'm just filling this in from my own kind of like made up headcanon, like, you know, potential observations of the character or whatever. But like, I think that, you know, probably what the chef said to him was like, hey, like, you know, we're all gonna die a violent death, but, you know, you have a choice right now where, you know, you can choose to, like, I think like part of the thing the chef was like trying to say to him is that he's like, you know, has no agency. He's just like following, he's like worshiping this chef and he has no agency of his own. And I think maybe the chef was like, this is how you can give yourself a choice or something. I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah, that's interesting. Cause I always like that particular sequence. To me, that was satire. In a way, like it was
when he's cooking, it's satire, but when he hangs himself, I feel like it takes it beyond satire. I don't know. Am I
maybe
wrong?
I'm not, maybe I need to review my English language terminology, but like, I think that it was in terms of like a literal plot sequence, it was over the top and rushed and everything. But the point is that Tyler had bought into the cult, even though he wasn't a professional chef. He cared so much about his own, about the cult of the chef and
like trying
his
to
own perceived expertise in food that when it was like laid before everyone that he does it, that he can't also do these things. Like the chef whispering something, like the chef dismissing him with something whispered in the ear was enough to make him want to take his life. And I keep thinking about, like, I don't remember exactly how far apart they were in terms of release time, but there's that infamous scene in the first season of The Bear when Joel McHale's character, the chef, says, you should be, like, whispers, you should be dead to Carmi's character. Sorry, to Carmi. And it's the same dynamic. It's the same, like, someone really trying to be a part of that scene and to be constantly, like, kept out of it or to be told that they're not good enough. I don't know. That, like, to me, that was the, like, satire might not be the right word, but it was over the top. It made sense within the world. But to me, it was, like, a distinct, like, pointing out of that power dynamic and that emotional state.
Yeah, you are 100% correct. And what I'm about to say isn't meant to like argue against that. When I watched it the first time, that's exactly how I felt. I was like, he was shamed into, you know, killing, like, they, you know, he was, yeah, exactly. He's like so bought in, he so badly wants to be a part of what they're doing. He wants to be a part of their cult of perfection, and, you know, like, he's just like, he's an outsider, but he worships them already. And then the chef puts him in a situation where, yeah, he makes a fool, has to make a fool of himself. And he's obviously like totally ashamed of what he does. And you know, like, I think that, you know, there's definitely a part of what the movie's saying is like, you know, all of this pressure and all of this, like, you know, unattainable perfection is what would drive some, like, would drive, like, what, the sous chef, what was his name? Anyways, he was the fourth course. It was like his mess. I can't remember his name right now. All of that pressure and not being able to achieve what you wish you could achieve, you know, would, you know, potentially drive you to do something like that if you were really, you know, emotionally distraught. And that's definitely what the movie is trying to say with Tyler's scene. But I also think that, like, I don't know. There is something sort of like weirdly compassionate about how the chef deals with Tyler in a way. And there, and he also shows compassion to Margot. And that's mostly because she's not supposed to be there. And mm-hmm. he's like, how do I get out of this situation where I have to now subject somebody to this who I don't necessarily think deserves it? You know, and he makes a couple plays to like try and get her to die with them because that would make him feel better or something. But I do think that like he wants it all to make sense. I don't think that he gave Tyler that assignment necessarily because he wanted to show him how bad a failure he would be. I kind of think that he just wanted to give him a dose of reality and that. Yeah, I don't know. It's like what I'm saying is just made up, but it just occurred to me that maybe it's not just, maybe he didn't say something that was just like belittling in that moment. Because mm-hmm. like, I don't know, it just, it kind of bothered me in the first one that like, yeah, he says something to him, you don't find out what it is. Why don't you find out what it is? If it's something belittling, then you would think that they would just show you that if that's supposed to be the point of the scene. They would just tell you what it was. And I think the reason why it's left to the viewer to decide what he says is because maybe he didn't say something belittling. Maybe he said something else, but then it still resulted in the same thing or something. I don't know. Because I think it's a really deliberate choice that you don't hear what the chef says to him. You know, it would be easy to be like, yeah, you're never going to be good and you should just go take your own life or something, right? Like if the movie was like, it seems like a conscious choice to let the viewer interpret it, you know, because they don't put that line in there. So I, mm-hmm. yeah, I was just found myself thinking like, oh, like what if he didn't say something just to belittle him? What if he said something else? But mm-hmm. yeah, I don't know. So there was a, when I was watching it the second time, there was like a lot more time to reflect on those types of things and come up with my own little right. theories about things and stuff. Mm-hmm. So I kind of enjoyed it.
Well,
and the cheeseburger looks good, but like,
what?
They're not just going to have. Well,
are you going to nitpick the cheeseburger now?
They're not just going to have a beautiful hamburger bun laying around. Like, I don't know. Like to produce that hamburger bun would take like 3 or 4 hours, at least.
I don't know, Shale. The fryers were still on, so
that is true. Is the fryer still on? Yeah.
That was
so that was a fried hamburger bun then.
After when she requested a hamburger and crinkle cut fries or whatever it was.
Yeah.
That was the first thing
she said, does that come with fries? And he's like, is the fryer still on? That was funny.
Not do we have hamburger buns?
Yeah, no. Well, he literally told Tyler like 15 minutes before that they have everything. So yeah. I was like, that's kind of weird.
Yeah, doesn't he say that to Margot? She's like, well, what do you have? And he's like, we have everything, right? Or no?
Maybe. Yeah, you might be right. Yeah.
Anyways.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, anyway, I watched it. I guess while we're on the subject, are we allowed to talk about the horror movie that you watched in your annual horror movie watch-off?
Sure. Lisa and I actually stayed for the double feature, which we haven't done in a few years.
Oh, wow, cool.
We watched, the first one was The Taking of Deborah Logan. Ever heard of it?
Okay. Yeah. Is it kind of an exorcism thing?
Absolutely it is. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I have seen it.
And found footage. Yeah.
Yeah.
Kind of like the postmodern found footage. That's like some found footage, but like also like with inlaid documentary pieces and
right.
Like it, yeah. And
a lot of CCTV footage.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. That's right. And it was fine. It was, if you're familiar with the subgenre of possession films, it retreaded a lot of things, but it was well made, I think.
Yeah, I remembered liking it quite a bit when I watched it.
And then the second one was Evil Dead Rise, which is...
Oh, really?
we almost... That is not the type of movie that we usually watch at these nights.
No, that, like, I don't know, like, because I talk, what's your friend's name who puts on the night? Neil, right. I've talked to Neil about it a few times, and yeah, it's always sort of seemed like he's looking for things that will be a little bit kind of like for a broader audience and, you know, maybe not too hard to stomach, but man, that is one of the goriest movies I've ever seen.
Yeah. It's like the movies we've watched in the past, there's usually a gory scene or element or threat of gore or whatever, but this
they're
is
horror
like
movies,
a,
so
usually it's more like a, like there's some kind of supernatural element or whatever. And yeah, maybe there's some gore, but this one was just like the point of the movie was the gore, and it was,
it was just like start to finish buckets of blood, crazy, like
it was a bit
action horror. Just, yeah.
Yeah.
That's pretty crazy. Fun watch. Did you like it?
No.
Okay. A little too much. Yeah, that's fair.
Well, like it does, because it kind of, I mean, Shale, you're the cinephile. To me, it's like it's meant to be a little bit cheeky, right? It's supposed to be a little bit campy. Well, sorry, it is extremely campy.
Yeah.
Like it's like,
oh, for sure.
And so it's, I don't know, is it like a throwback or something? Like, but it, I don't.
Yeah.
Like I feel like it's like if it is to horror movies, or sorry, to, I'm thinking that like it's like what Kill Bill is to Kung Fu movies, where it's just like,
right,
it's kind of like an homage, a campy throwback kind of thing that I don't really like the original genre, and I don't really like the reboot of it or whatever.
Have you seen any of the original Evil Dead movies? Like, have you seen Evil Dead 2 or Army of Darkness? Yeah. So it would be that movie would have like, then Evil Dead Rise would have like a very weird tone, because I guess this is a movie podcast now, but Evil Dead 2 and Army of Darkness were, the first Evil Dead movie was Sam Raimi, who's like a pretty famous movie director. It was like his very first feature film. Mm. And then Evil Dead 2 was kind of just like a remake of Evil Dead, but just when he had more backing and he could get more money to actually make movie that the way he wanted to. Mm-hmm. And it's definitely like super gory horror comedy. Like it's 100% supposed to be a comedy. It's still scary, I think, like pretty scary, or at the time it was. And it's like really gory and has tons of horror movie tropes, but is definitely supposed to be a comedy. And then Army of Darkness is also kind of a horror action movie, but it is just straight up a comedy. So like,
really? Okay.
Yeah. So several years ago, like 6 or 7 years ago, there was a remake of Evil Dead by a director called Fede Alvarez. He's since gone on to make a couple other like pretty high profile movies. He made a movie called Don't Breathe that was like really popular a few years ago. It's really good. Mm-hmm. About some teenagers that break into a blind man's house, and he's like ex-army and he just like messes with them.
Okay.
And then he directed the most recent Alien movie, Alien Romulus, that came out this year, which I thought was quite good. Mm-hmm. Anyway, he did an Evil Dead remake 6, 7, 8 years ago, something. And it was very gory, a little more serious, still kind of comedic, but like, yeah, also incredibly gory. And then it was pretty successful. And so Evil Dead Rise was supposed to sort of be connected to that, mm-hmm. the like remake. And so, yeah, but the tone of those movies is very specific, because they're mimicking the tone of Sam Raimi's movies, not just like the horror genre or horror tropes, but very specifically Sam Raimi's horror movies. And that it's a very specific like filmic language and a very specific kind of humor. And if you hadn't ever been exposed to it before, then I could see how it would be like extremely difficult to like grasp the tone of that movie. You know, like it's really weird. It's really all over the place.
Like I'm usually the one who finds the subtle humor in something where others don't. Mm. But this one was like,
Yeah. Yeah. I think like a lot of the humor in Evil Dead Rise is like how over the top the stuff is, the gore and things like that.
Right.
Which, Yeah. Anyway, it's not a movie podcast. I'm sorry that we've been talking about movies for 10 minutes.
10 episodes, more like.
Yeah, no kidding.
Last episode was all about movies.
Yeah, but it was about food movies. We've gone completely off the, completely off our base now.
Here, I've got something random to talk about food with you.
Okay, good.
I had an interest. I had a dish that was really unlike anything I had had before recently here in Edmonton.
Oh, wow.
Thai boat noodles. Have you ever had boat noodles before?
Not that I'm aware of.
So I had these, the start of this story is, one of my students, we were having a conversation about salads in our class, in the garde-manger, because that's okay. An important part of garde-manger and cold kitchen is salads. And at the end of our kind of conversation of like tasting different salad greens and talking about different salad types and compositions, we were just like rattling off. So like, what are some of the most famous salads in the world? And we talked about Caesar salad and Greek salad and all this. And one of the things I wanted to talk about was green papaya salad.
Okay.
And so I told the class everything that I know about Thai style green papaya salad. And then of course, one of the students was like, yeah, I'm from Thailand. I know some things about that salad too. And then after, that conversation, I had asked her, so like, do you think there's any good Thai food, or can you tell me where to find
good Thai food? Do you think
there's
any good Thai food?
In Edmonton. Sorry, sentence was in Edmonton. And she was like, well, yeah, there's some. And I was like, okay, because I've been to, and I listed the two or three Thai restaurants that I've been to. She actually kind of laughed. She laughed at them.
Whoa, so I'm not going to tell you the names. no, I have to know, Alan. You like cannot do this to me.
Not a laugh, like a... something like a yeah. scoff or a chortle, perhaps. I don't know.
She's still anonymous. We don't know who this student of yours is. So,
and I was like, oh, well, what do you recommend? And so she recommended a restaurant and she recommended three or four dishes to try there because she didn't think she had seen them anywhere else in Edmonton.
Cool.
And the restaurant is Thai Avenue, which is... in one of the most, it's so far north that it's basically in Fort Saskatchewan, as far as I'm concerned. It's on 170th Avenue.
Holy smokes.
And the first thing that she said that I should try there is boat noodles, which I didn't even know what that was, but I went there and I ordered them. And Shale, you should try them. If you were in a dark room, you might think that you're looking at a bowl of pho. Like it's the same noodle, like the same rice noodles, long, slender, square cross section. It's in a bowl of broth. It's got like springy meatballs floating in it. It's got slices of meat in it.
You've got my vote, Alan.
But like I said, it really was unlike anything I had eaten before. First of all, the broth is thickened with blood. And so it has like a very distinct brown, like almost like opaque kind of murky appearance to it.
Gotcha.
Besides sliced pork, it's based on pork more than beef, I think. So like it has springy meatballs, but they're pork, and it has slices of pork liver and pork meat in it. But the broth, besides having blood in it, it's like intensely spiced with things like, I think like cinnamon and anise and stuff. And I don't mean like the way that pho is. It's like hot with cinnamon. Like,
wow.
And maybe it's not that, maybe that's not exactly, it's not that simple, I'm sure. But like,
yeah, of course.
Like cinnamon heart, or like, is that what they're called? Like the Valentine's Day candies? Like
might as well call them that.
Like I've never had that. Yeah, and still a little bit.
Yeah, you've never had like a hot cinnamon experience outside of candy, probably.
Yeah, and so it was delicious, but really, really unusual, and really for me, and really like unlike anything I'd had before.
Cool.
Yeah, recommend.
Right on. What else? Did you have anything else there?
I had the green papaya salad.
Oh, okay. And how was that? Edible?
It was great.
Sometimes it's so spicy. But
well, okay, I was just gonna say, Thai student was really upset when I told her this later, but I had the boat noodles there at the restaurant, and then I asked for a green papaya salad to go, and I had it for lunch the next day, and she said, you're not supposed to do that. Like, you're supposed to eat it after it's mixed, or the day that it's mixed. It is the only salad that has made me cry. It was so hot. I couldn't believe, like, because we've had, like, whatever, I'm not
pinchingly hot. Yeah.
Like, I'm not trying to be macho, but like, I can eat Sichuan stuff or whatever. But like, this, it was so hot, I was weeping. Like,
yeah, I've had papaya salads like that too. And like, it's an amazing, like, fresh tasting experience, but it's also like really hard. Like, I don't know. It's like, yeah, my palate is just not used to that. And so it just makes it a really painful experience. And that's unfortunate because I can tell that it's delicious, but it's also like, yeah, exactly. When I've had one that's like really spicy, it's just like painful. And I don't enjoy that. Like, I don't enjoy the, like, I enjoy like a little bit of like pain from heat, like a little bit, like living on the edge, like, oh man, is this going to get like too hot where I'm going to be like crying or whatever? I enjoy that. I enjoy a certain amount of that like hot sensation. But yeah, when it actually gets to the point where I can't eat anything and I'm just like drooling and crying and you know, like, I don't find that fun. And I know some people do, like, as an extreme experience. But I think the people that eat that type of papaya salad, like, on the daily in Thailand, probably are probably much more accustomed to eating way spicier food than I am. And so, like, you know, it's not really fair to try and give me that experience because I can't have it, you know? Like,
I still kind of like it because
I don't want to have to muscle through. Like, it's not
for that particular salad. Like I said, I had it to go, and so I ate it at home the next day. And I did, even though it was pretty painful, I still like kept going back to it and it was able to appreciate it. I find it like much more difficult in your, like, if you're dining in a restaurant with other people to be experiencing that. It's like, yeah, because you're very self, well, I'm very self-conscious.
Yeah. Yeah. No, yeah, me too. While we're talking about it, I'm like having flashbacks to when I ate hot chicken at Hattie B's in Nashville. Yeah. Cause I ordered one piece of the hot and for whatever reason, because I'm a dummy, I decided to eat that one first. Right. Cause I was like, okay, I'll eat this. And like, you know, if it's really hot, I'll kind of like get it out of the way and then I can enjoy the rest of my meal.
Right.
I was like, yeah, just like sitting there in the booth, like crying, or like sitting there at a picnic table crying for like 25 minutes. And then I didn't actually like finish the rest of my meal. But yeah, it was like so painful. And I was like, I mean, I get it, but it's just not for me. You know, I'm not in there eating hot chicken every day. And then one day I'm like, I'll move up to the medium. And then like a year later, I'm like, you know what? I'm going to start eating the hot. Like, yeah, it's not like that for me.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, add to the
list. Anyway, that's really interesting. Thai Avenue. 100 and Fort McMurray Ave. Got it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It always feels like I live like fairly, like, I mean, as far as like central, I live as far north as you can still be central in Edmonton, I guess is what I'm trying to say. Right. But like sometimes, you know, like I have several friends who live like, you know, north of the Yellowhead and like I go to their places all the time and, you know, that seems normal. But when I'm actually like driving to some place that's like way in the north, I'm like, can't believe there's still city up here. Like it's just like it doesn't exist for me until I drive up there and then I'm like, I can't believe this is all up here.
You're a central Edmonton chauvinist.
Yeah, I really am. It's unfortunate. Sorry to any of our north side listeners. Is that it for follow-up, Alan?
Yeah.
Okay. I have a what? Announcement? Yeah, sure. Yeah. Let's call it an announcement. Oh, by the way, before I do an announcement, we do kind of have a topic for this episode.
Yeah.
I'm sure we'll get to it. So the announcement is this. after nearly 4 years of making this podcast every 2 weeks. I'm going to start this again. Should have thought about this before I went to say it.
You should have asked ChatGPT to write you some.
Yeah, I should have. The podcast has been going for a long time. In the last year or so, I think to some extent, both Alan and I have sometimes found it, difficult to like come up with topics for the show, that we haven't already talked about, or that we think will be new or fresh or interesting for the listeners. So that's been a little bit difficult. And then also, we both have lives and jobs outside of the show. Sometimes it's difficult for us to schedule the right time to record. And some of that like makes the actual recording and editing of the show a little bit, I wouldn't say stressful, but sometimes I don't know, what's the right word, Alan?
Challenging.
Challenging. Yeah, challenging. That's a great word. So we had a conversation a little while ago, a few weeks ago.
At
the Red Goose. Yeah, totally. And then we talked about the Red Goose on the show, didn't we? So that'll give you a bit of an idea of how long ago we sort of like kind of started talking about this. In the near future, we're going to be putting the show on hiatus for a little while. And we thought that episode 100 would be like a really good sort of like breaking point. So maybe episode 1 to 100. And by the way, the episode that you're listening to right now is episode 98. And so episode 100 will be not our next episode, but the one after that. So episode 100 is going to mark, I guess, maybe what, season one of Food Court or something like that. I don't really know. We haven't really gotten into too many specifics about, what's going to happen once we put the show on hiatus, but episode 100 seemed like a really good breaking point. I think we do both want to maybe, reconsider the format of the show a little bit. I think one of the things, one of the things that I think we both love about the show is that it's sort of like a outlet for us to talk about, whatever we kind of want to. Any food stuff that we have kicking around in our head, we can just sort of like use it as a topic, and that gives us an opportunity to talk about it. And that's been great because, I get to have a conversation about something that I love with my good friend Alan. And, I hope that it comes across that that's basically what we're doing on the show, is just having a conversation that we might normally have. I think like something that, has sort of like come out of that kind of format of the show is that, listeners don't always know what to expect. And so some episodes might really be up someone's alley, and other episodes may not really be something that they're interested in. And maybe that's fine. For a lot of people, they'll just like listen to the ones that they really want to, and, skip through the ones that they don't. And like, obviously that's totally fine. But I think that we'd like to maybe take some time, think about the show, and think about like a format where it's more like the listener will know what to expect from week to week. Maybe tighten it up a little bit time-wise. I think, every episode would be maybe closer to like 40 minutes than like, I think probably the average now is around 80 or 90, something like that. So a little bit shorter, a little bit more focused. And we have a few ideas for, what we might want to do, how we might want to transition the show into that. I think part of the idea, a lot of our listenership is Edmonton based, and I think it would be nice to have something that is consistently a little bit more sort of locally focused or something like that. So that's sort of what we have kicking around in our head. That being said, we're hoping to make episode 100 a little bit of like a retrospective of the show. You know, maybe go back and talk about some of our favorite conversations, some of our favorite moments, some of our favorite episodes. So if you, as a listener, have things that you wish that we had talked about that we haven't talked about yet, or have questions about the show or anything that might sort of like fit the bill for us to talk about in a bit of a show retrospective, we'd love to hear from you in the next 3 weeks and gather some input or suggestions from the listener base about things that we can talk about on what will be for now the final episode. And then also, if you have ideas for, you know, things that you maybe would like to see in the format of the show once it sort of gets retooled and reannounced, then we'd love to hear that too. We don't really have a timeline for when we're going to try to bring the show back. I think we want to give ourselves some time to sort of like disconnect from how it is now. I imagine that it will probably be several months. But if you're interested in continuing to listen to the show after we come back, you can just keep the your subscription to this podcast feed, and we will be posting new episodes of the show once it comes back in this same podcast feed. So if you stay subscribed, whenever the show comes back, it will just automatically download to your podcast player and you'll know we're back. And we'll probably try to do some pre-announcements and things like that on social media, like on Instagram and stuff. But just wanted to let everybody know that this is one of three final episodes of the current iteration of the show. And it's been such a pleasure doing it. And I just wanted to give everybody a heads up and not sort of just like on the last episode say, hey, and by the way, we're peacing out for a while. So yeah, I wanted to give everybody a little bit of warning and definitely drop us a line if you have suggestions for things that we can talk about on episode 100 of the Food Court Podcast.
Volume one.
That's right. Yeah. It's the first volume of the show, I guess is a better way of putting it than the first season.
A very voluminous volume show.
It is. Yeah. I mean, I think most shows would make like seasons a year long or volumes a year long or something like that. But yeah, it's always kind of been a running joke in my head when I post the show that like, in the podcast information that you provide to whatever podcast host your show is on, when you post it, it asks you what season of the show it is that you're currently in. And I think it's always hilarious every time I put season one, because we've been doing the show for 4 years. Mm-hmm. And I just think it's funny that that's one season.
Well said, Jill.
Thanks, Alan. So, with that out of the way, what are we going to talk about?
Sometimes you ask me that when...
And it's my topic. I know, I do it all the time. I think it's funny.
I do have an idea for an intro for it, actually.
Oh, you do?
Well, it was kind of...
Okay.
So
let's have at it then.
So you told me the idea for the topic, and what it reminded me of is that there's a handful of like these things that we as Edmontonians say or believe about our own food scene.
Right. Yeah.
And mm-hmm. So for like a small example, something that is widely said and widely believed, I don't know if it's true, but an example is, Shil, you told me in a conversation before we were recording that you went to New Asian Village in West Edmonton last week. Yeah. And as soon as you said you went to New Asian Village, I was like, well, which one did you go to? Because everybody knows that the Mill Woods one is the best one because it's on 34th Avenue in like Edmonton's little
India town. And yeah,
I've never even eaten there, but for years people have told me that's the one that Indian Canadian Edmontonians go to.
Right.
But anyway, I can't corroborate that. But there's another thing.
Well, I have been to both.
Oh, okay. Okay.
I haven't been to the one on the south side in quite a while, several years, mm-hmm. like probably 4 or 5 years. Okay. But yeah, I ate at the one on the west end 2 days ago.
Right.
And from my recollection, they're pretty comparable.
Okay.
Yeah, like we're gonna organize. I definitely kind of have had better Indian food in other places, but they have a buffet there, so you can get in, eat quickly, and it's like the craziest buffet. It is like a mile long. There's like gotta be, I don't know, like more than 25 offerings. They have like a they have a dessert buffet, so like, you know, Indian desserts like gulab jamun and things that you would normally find in an Indian sweets shop or Indian dessert at an Indian restaurant. But they also have a soft serve machine with like vanilla soft serve and mango soft serve, which I think is just awesome.
Yum. Yeah.
Yeah. So the buffet is just like epic. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of cool. And then I don't exactly remember, but a bunch of the, like, it was my mom's birthday when we went and ate there the other day. And it definitely the reaction from some people who have also eaten at the Southside New Asian Village is that the decor was like fancier. So, yeah, okay. I don't know. And the table that we were at was crazy, too. It was a gigantic round table with a big Lazy Susan in the middle. Like, I don't even know how to describe it. Like, the chairs in there are like these big, heavy wooden carved chairs, and like everything is like really elaborate. But the table was just gigantic. Like, you're like 15 feet from the person that's sitting across from you or something. It was pretty sweet. Epic table.
The segue that I was working towards was...
Right, sorry to cut you off.
One of the other things that people... I've heard, certainly since I was in culinary school and many times after that, is that Edmonton is a common place for chain restaurants to trial new locations. Is that... Did I say that right?
Right. Yeah, that's the topic, yeah. So there is, yeah, some like conventional wisdom and some stories that I've read from news sources that, and also like there is like some common sense, practical anecdata about from living in Edmonton that says that Edmonton is like a pretty hot test market for chains that are considering either like moving into Canada from the States or broadening their reach outside of like Vancouver or Toronto if they're Canadian chains. Mm-hmm. So a lot of chain restaurants decide to open their sort of like expansion locations in Edmonton. And that's because theoretically, demographically, and I don't know, for whatever reasons, Edmonton seems like a good market to trial a new store in. And so that's kind of what we were going to talk about. Well, there's kind of two pieces to it. There's like the idea that Edmonton is, for some reason, weirdly a good test market for like these chain restaurants. And then also, on top of that, there are several chain restaurants that have started in Edmonton. I don't really know what the numbers are compared to like how many chain restaurants come out of other cities, but it seems like a lot of pretty big chains have started here. And
you think Edmonton punches above its weight? Is that what you mean?
Maybe, yeah. Like, I guess that's what we're here to find out. Okay. Does Edmonton punch above its weight? I don't know.
Okay.
So what do you think? Well,
I'm dying to know.
Okay, so from some of the stories that I read, some of them were pretty recent, and they were talking about like sort of places that have opened up here recently, and made mention of things like Jollibee,
yeah,
and
Seafood City. There's probably. Like,
what's that?
Probably Seafood City. I think Edmonton had one before Calgary.
But. Oh, right. Yeah. Seafood City. That's a good example, actually. I don't know if that has to do with the fact that Edmonton's a good test market or just that there's like a large Filipino community here. That one I think would be difficult to disambiguate. Mm-hmm. But there's also what's it called? There's like an American Texas style barbecue chain. I'm going to look it up here. Oh, Dickie's barbecue pit. Apparently there's a Dickie's in Edmonton, which I haven't heard of, but apparently it's a big chain in Texas. And I mean, when you think about Alberta and Texas and all of the like associated kind of similarities there, I think when people found out that they were moving a chain here, they were like, oh, this is a great story about how Albertans are just like Texans, right. Which is, I think, why this story got a little bit of traction at the time. But apparently, and I don't know if it's still open now, but apparently there's a P.F. Chang's here.
Oh, really?
Which is a huge like Chinese chain in the States. Mm-hmm. There's another chain that moved here that I haven't heard of called California Pizza.
That's funny. One of my students told me about that this week. His favorite place to eat in Edmonton. Yep.
California Pizza. Yeah, I've never been, never heard of it. Apparently it's a chain, and Edmonton was like their first test market in Canada.
Mm-hmm. It's in South Common, I think.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm around South Common fairly often, so maybe I'll try to stop by. And then in this story that I read, it also said that 7-Eleven opened a test like store in North Edmonton where it's like licensed to serve booze. So there's like a part of the 7-Eleven where you can sit down and eat your food. I don't know if they have special food there or if you just get a hot dog like the same as you would at any 7-Eleven. But then yeah, you can sit down and have an alcoholic beverage in the 7-Eleven.
Huh.
Don't know if it still exists, but apparently it did exist. At least in 2022 and 2023. So okay. Yeah, what's the deal? Why is it? I can tell you what the story says about why Edmonton seems like an attractive test market.
Okay.
And those things are that like one of the things that they say is that Edmonton is underserved. So what does that mean, Alan? What does underserved mean?
There aren't as many restaurants. Sorry, it means the supply and demand don't meet is what it's talking about.
Yeah, like, yeah. So we don't have as many chain restaurants as others. Yeah, yeah.
That seems unbelievable to me, but...
It seems shocking, yeah, because it seems like all we have... I shouldn't say that. We have lots of great independent restaurants. Mm-hmm. But yeah, like sometimes when I'm driving around the city or like talking to people about places to eat, it feels like all anyone is aware of is chain restaurants. Mm-hmm. It also is because Edmonton apparently has like a very food aware population and a diverse population. So like... Mm-hmm. Diverse demographics for trying different types of food and people that are aware of a lot of different types of food, I guess probably because we have some, I don't know, diverse communities here, mm-hmm. where we already have like a lot of different Asian and African and Eastern European and a lot of different food influences in Edmonton. So people are aware of a lot of different types of food.
Okay.
And then I agree. Also,
Maybe list through the reasons and then we'll address them.
Okay, yeah. And then finally, real estate here is cheap. So it's like less than half the price to rent the same size of restaurant in a suburb here than it would be to like try and rent a similar space in like Vancouver or Toronto. So it's like a little bit less of an investment.
Right. Well, I certainly believe that, but it does beg the question, like why Edmonton? And like, I mean, you know what's even cheaper? Winnipeg. Why wouldn't they go to Winnipeg?
Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question. Definitely Winnipeg has a diverse population. So, yeah, I don't know.
And it can't... Like,
maybe it's just too cold there.
Maybe. It has to be a combination of the factors because, yes, there's a diverse population in Edmonton, but like it's not as diverse as Vancouver or...
Right.
You know,
well, I don't know. The article said that it's more diverse than Vancouver. So I don't know. Maybe that's.
Oh, yeah. Maybe in terms of the actual. Yeah. Like distribution.
Yeah.
Okay.
Another thing that they did mention that I've seen mentioned in a couple of articles is that the mall is here. And so there's like, I don't know. I guess that's good because maybe you can open in the mall, and then you can, oh yeah, like one of the articles that I read mentioned Bubba Gump Shrimp, which I think, like, I don't know if there are any other locations in Canada, but I'm pretty sure the first location was in West Edmonton Mall, and it's still there. And yeah, so there's a mall where there's like a high density of foot traffic where, yeah, you can maybe rent a space that's like, you know, you don't have to build a building or, you know, outfit a building to be a restaurant necessarily or something like that. You know, so you can kind of maybe turnkey a restaurant in the mall, and that gives you like a really good sort of access to a broad customer base immediately or something like that. I don't know.
Right. I'm intrigued by the, well, maybe just because it's flattering, but the point that Edmonton is a very food aware city. Is that how it was put?
Yeah, I think so.
That was actually something in a completely different context. And I can't remember if this came up in our conversation about it, but when Blair Lebsack was the chef in residence at Nate this right. past spring, that was something that he cited as being enjoyable and actually in some ways challenging for him as a restaurateur, because he felt that like that Edmontonians basically cook for each other a lot more than lots of people in bigger cities. And I don't know, like, this is again, like, it's not, this is not a stat. This is just like anecdotal, but I kind of believe it. Like, if, you know, the places that I stay, say like the Airbnb that I stayed at in New York, like the person who was hosting us, like they ate out all the time, but that didn't mean that they understood food better because they almost never cooked at home.
Right.
And so, yeah, Blair specifically said, like, if you, and you know, as Range Road does every day, like if you serve pierogies in Edmonton, like you're serving to a very discerning clientele and they're going to be critical of it. And if you, you know, that's one very specific preparation and stuff, but, yeah, I don't know if those two things are related, but that's what jumped to mind, is that even though it might be easy or voguish to say like, oh man, Edmonton's just like a chain restaurant kind of town, like maybe there's something going on that, yeah, like.
Yeah, I wonder too, like, it, you know, like if that maybe, you know, like if we do have a lot of like, different cultural populations, maybe a lot of the reason why a lot of people prepare food at home is because it's, you know, like in North America, the food culture, yeah, tends to be like, you know, restaurant culture in a way, right? Like in a lot of ways, maybe not, you know, maybe that's only in the last 50 or 60 years or something, but I feel like, you know, a lot of the food culture in North America is restaurant culture, but you know, that's not the case in most other places in the world. And so, you know, if Edmonton has a lot of culturally diverse communities, then maybe there are just a lot more people who cook the foods that, you know, like their own cultural home cooked dishes at home a lot more than, you know, maybe in other places or something like that.
I don't know. That's a pretty, I think that's a lot.
I mean,
like it's, I think a lot more nuanced than just saying like food culture, North American food culture is restaurant culture. Cause I think in some ways, like our restaurant culture is very different than in Europe. Like for us, like going out, I don't know. If you think about like,
I mean, I guess like the way that we treat, I'm sort of like picturing in my head when I'm saying that is like fast food and like chains and things like that, you know, like a lot of our exposure to food is like, and a lot of our like cultural nostalgia and stuff is around things like processed food and fast food and chain restaurant food and things like that. It's not that there doesn't exist like a home cooking culture, and there are definitely regional pockets of like really amazing home cooking. But like when you think about, oh, yeah, okay, so like what about something like Texas barbecue, right? Like when you think about Texas barbecue, do you think about like Texans in their backyard, or do you think about them going to a barbecue pit or something?
The second one.
You know? Like, it's maybe a bit of both, But, you know, I think that a lot of it is like, you know, maybe people don't always have time to like smoke a brisket for 24 hours, but a restaurant does, you know, and that's sort of like more what I'm making reference to, like even the regional cultural, like food sort of the foods that get popularized culturally in like different regions. A lot of it has to do with like, you know, the popularity of a certain kind of restaurant food.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, obviously there are a lot of, I mean, like you would never call Nanaimo bars restaurant food.
That's true. I would not. Yeah.
Right. And you know, there are lots of things like that, you know, that are like regional inventions in Canada or in the United States that, you know, have nothing to do with like restaurant food and that are definitely a part of our food culture. But I do think that it's heavily influenced by like fast food and chain restaurants and stuff like that.
Well, it's funny because like my, and this is probably just because I'm so naive about it, but sure, I can think of like my knowledge of food traditions, say in Italy, probably have more to do with home cooking than with restaurant cooking in Italy. But when I think about Japanese food, I only think about food that's served in restaurants, really. Like, I don't think people, I think that, correct me if I'm wrong, Jill, like, wouldn't you say that certainly ramen and probably things as ubiquitous as sushi are much more associated with restaurants than home cooking in Japan?
Absolutely. 100%. Yeah. And the food that people eat at home in Japan is often quite different from those things. Yeah.
So I recently watched, there was one of the old Bourdain shows where he was hanging out with Masa Takayama, who is like, I think the restaurant's called Masa in Manhattan, and it's supposed to be the best sushi maybe in the United States, certainly in New York. But he went to Masa's childhood village in Japan, and I think
and
he
eats with his family.
Yeah, ate with his mom, yeah. I think. And all.
I did rewatch this episode recently, actually. I'm surprised that I didn't remember. Yeah, yeah.
And it makes sense, but like I realized watching that my exposure to Japanese food is entirely through their restaurant culture, because watching them cook at home, even like the orientation of and the equipment that they had in the, and this might have been a special case because he's a famous chef, but the orientation of the room and the equipment and the food they were eating was it had nothing to do with my
perception of like Japanese restaurant food.
Perception of Japanese food.
Although
that being said, if anything, it was much more similar to our own home cooking. Like it was like,
right.
It was grilled meat and fermented vegetable and like, but it wasn't.
Yeah. Although they did have a huge pile of like amazing tuna sashimi, just like a gigantic pile. Too, yeah.
But that's not like Tuesday night for them. I don't think.
No, that's because Bourdain's there and because Masa's home from the States or whatever. Yeah, right. No, yeah, for yeah. sure. But yeah, definitely. I, you know, like in modern Japan, I think that probably, you know, their food culture is also, yeah, heavily influenced by A, Western culture, and B, like Japanese restaurant culture. So yeah, I don't know. Like, yeah, there are lots of fast food restaurants in Japan, Japanese ones and American ones. So yeah, I would say, I don't know, maybe it's more of like a first world thing or something. I don't know. But like, yeah, I do think in Europe, there's a lot less, you know, like I don't think that people in Italy are as nostalgic about McDonald's as people in Canada and the States are.
Certainly not. You know,
right?
To the contrary. Like,
yeah, it's derided. Yeah, exactly. Whereas in Japan, it's not really derided. Like, I don't know. It's interesting. It's an interesting...
Did you...
What? When you were, dichotomy.
When you were in... I think it's in Venice. There's a statue there. Maybe you saw it. Because you went to Venice or no?
I did go to Venice. Yeah.
There's a statue.
I wasn't there for very long, and I was there for longer than I there for shorter than I had planned because I wasn't having a great time when I was there.
Yeah, well, it can be horrible there. there's a statue, and I think it's kind of structured like a famous sculpture. I couldn't tell you the name of it, but I believe it's meant to be David and Goliath. And David has slain Goliath, and he is holding the decapitated head of the giant up over his head. But it's instead of Goliath's head, it's Ronald McDonald's head.
Really?
Yeah. Did you see that?
No.
It's either David and Goliath, or perhaps like after Perseus kills Medusa and he holds up Medusa's head. Yeah. It might be that. I can't remember. But yeah, a huge severed Ronald McDonald head being held aloft.
Oh my God. That is hilarious.
Yeah.
That's like soon going to be like unrecognizable to any like anyone under the age of like 20 or something, because like Ronald McDonald is being like completely what's that like what do they call it when they like try to erase memory. Like what's that?
Yeah, do you mean like the Latin phrase for trying to delete someone from history? Is that what you're talking about?
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I can't remember the phrase, but like when
yeah.
Like
anyways, Ronald McDonald is like being the entire like McDonald Land gang, except for Grimace, I guess, because they had a Grimace shake last year. But like, there are no more like they've like taken out. I watched a really interesting talk about by this guy. His name is Cable Sasser. He's like he owns like a tech company. But I wouldn't call him like a tech billionaire or anything. He's just like a really interesting designer, and he has a lot of really unique interests. And like one of his interests is like Americana. And he went to a McDonald's somewhere in Oregon, I think, and they had this amazing mural that was like on the wall in there. It was like all of the McDonaldland characters in kind of like a, I don't know, like a painting layout, like where you like one of those paintings where you just have like a whole bunch of characters and they're all sort of engaged in like different things. I forget what that's called, like a tableau or something. Anyway, it was amazing, and he did all this research to find out who the artist was, and he was like an artist that did a lot of work for like theme parks and Disney, and like, you know, invented, he was also like kind of an engineer, and he invented a bunch of stuff for like theme parks. And And he like, yeah, painted all of this like McDonaldland stuff, and it was just all getting like trashed. Anyway, he like rescued this painting, and it's pretty amazing. Okay. Yeah. I'll put a link to the video about it in the show notes because it's pretty fascinating. Maybe I'm the only person that thinks it's fascinating.
But. I'm sure it's not true. So like Ronald McDonald is because in the modern zeitgeist, clowns are horrifying and...
Yeah, and I think it's just like a branding thing. They want to like, I think they're trying to like age up their branding a little bit or something. Right. Or like, I'm not exactly sure. Like, simplify their branding. They don't want to have like this whole, you know, theme park land of characters idea attached to their branding or something. Yeah, nightmarish. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Nightmarish depictions.
How is the hamburger not aged well? That seems.
Anyways, getting back to the topic at hand.
What was that again?
Yeah, so like, I guess like what other chains can you think? Like, so one that was like, when I was reading this article, it was kind of about like the older, like some of the status of Edmonton's like older attractiveness to like as like a test market. One of the big examples is like Outback Steakhouse. Apparently one of the first Outback Steakhouses in Canada was like right across from West Edmonton Mall.
Oh, is that right? Because in my mind, Outback is owned by the same group as Kelsey's and Montana's. Is that true?
I don't know if they were at the time, but maybe Montana's. I don't know if Montana's had one of their first stores here or not, but yeah, I had it. Red Robin, apparently.
Really? I don't even know where that's like, from originally.
I think it's from the States. I'm not positive. Could be from Vancouver, but I think it's from the States. And I don't know if Edmonton was like one of the first cities that it came to in Canada. But I think it was like one of their biggest markets, like in Western Canada. Like there were a lot of Red Robins here. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Is that like, it's funny because like when these places open, like, yeah, in this one article that I was reading about Dickies, they said that like people were lining up like the day before to go eat there. And right. it seems like chain restaurants that are like considering opening locations in Edmonton are always very successful at creating a lot of buzz before they open right. somehow and getting people to be like really excited. And then they're like lined up for like weeks after they open and you can't like even try to go there or something. It's crazy.
That's definitely like a favorite local news style of story. Like, cause I've heard that. I definitely heard about that Jollibee.
Yeah.
There was stories about the lineups.
Man, that Jollibee was lined up for months. I swear, like 2 months later, you would still had to go line up to go eat there. Mm-hmm. And now there's like 5 Jollibees or whatever.
Yeah, but that's right. Yeah. Peter's Drive-In, not exactly a foreign import, but pretty severe traffic issues caused when Peter's opened their Edmonton location.
Yeah, for sure. Something else that I read while reading these articles is that apparently Edo Japan, which seems like a international chain to me or something, like I just think that they're everywhere. I don't know. Maybe they're only in Canada, but apparently that was started in Calgary. So that's interesting too.
Huh, really?
Yeah. And there was like, they were everywhere in like every mall.
Yeah. Every campus food court. Every
yeah, exactly. Mall. Yeah. I went to one in the last year. Yeah, boy. Like the least expensive thing that you could buy was like $25 or something. And it was pretty much the same as it used to be. They have sushi there now. They have quote unquote sushi there now. Mm-hmm. But yeah, like just getting like teppanyaki food like you would or whatever. It was like, yeah, it was like 20. You can't get out without paying $25. It was crazy. Yeah. It's not worth that, people. Don't go there. You can get a lot of good Japanese food for $25. Edo is not it. Kind of what started me thinking about, like, because I have heard before that Edmonton is a popular test market for chain restaurants, but like kind of what started me thinking about it was that 2 ramen chains have opened here in like the last 6 weeks.
Okay.
So like ramen is blowing up, which, you know, nice for Shale. I like ramen, but like, it's kind of crazy. Like, one of them's from the States. It's called mm-hmm. Jinya. They have a location on 109th Street, just south of Jasper Ave.
Yeah.
Right near District Cafe.
In the old, it was a Vietnamese place before, like a Ha Luang.
Oh, maybe. Something. Yeah. I think so. Yeah. I think so. Yeah, like a fairly long place, like long, narrow space. Yeah. Yeah. So they opened like, I don't know, 5 or 6 weeks ago or something. I just happened to be like looking on Instagram and saw that there was like something about some ramen shop called Jinya. And I was like, oh, this is in Edmonton. Oh, this is a chain. Oh, they're opening. Then I was like, and then I looked like on their like, website and they were opening that very day that I happened to see that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is like strange. Mm. That's why I was like a little bit like, how did these restaurants create all this buzz? Because I just happened to find out that they were opening on the day that they were opening. And then we went there and we had to wait about 20 minutes to get in. But my sister and I went and ate there. And then tonight, before we recorded this show, we were like sitting around thinking about what we should do for dinner. And my sister came across something on Instagram saying that there's a place, a new ramen shop called Midori opening on 34th Ave at like 103rd Street.
Okay. Yeah.
And tonight was their very first soft open night. And we went and tried it. That was pretty good.
It's a chain as well.
Yeah, it's also a chain. I think it's a Canadian chain. I think it's from Toronto. So, test market, Edmonton. yeah. And also, another like local independent ramen shop just opened last week here, too. What used to be Casey Ramen is now a brick and mortar shop called Menu Mori. And I was lucky enough to get in on their second dinner service, and it was really good.
Awesome.
Yeah, the best ramen I've had in the city. Cool. I've had their kits several times, and their kits were always good. But like, I don't know, sometimes when you're preparing it at home, it's just like, maybe you're not quite getting it right, you know?
Right. Yeah.
And, yeah, the food that I had at their restaurant was pretty much perfect. It was great. So anyways, yeah. What has Edmonton then contributed to the world of chain restaurants?
I only one thing comes to mind.
Okay. What is it?
Boston Pizza.
Okay. Yeah. Boston Pizza. That one's real. That one is like inarguable, right. I guess. Yeah. And it's a huge chain. I don't know. Do they have stores in the States?
I don't know if they do. I'm not sure.
Yeah. Anyway, they have a lot of stores in Canada. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that was started in Edmonton on, I think, 124th Street, something like that.
Oh,
I read something about it. Yeah. And apparently started by a Greek owner, I believe. Yeah.
Yeah. And then famously acquired by Jim Treliving.
Oh, really? I don't know anything about that.
Yeah, like it was Jim Treliving is the he's the one who franchised it.
I see.
I don't know. I'm sure there's like a really lovely, quaint story about his love for the original business, like on some Dragon's Den episode or something. But it's now in it's surprisingly ubiquitous in like, you know, small town, medium sized town Canada. Like there will be a McDonald's, a Tim Hortons, a Subway, and a Boston Pizza. Like for a sit down restaurant, it's in every kind of mid sized town, certainly in Alberta.
Totally. And then I guess we've kind of argued about this before, but there is something to be said for the idea that Earl's also started here.
If you say so.
Maybe the original Earl's restaurant wasn't here, but I think started franchising from here.
I mean, Earl's itself claims that it started in Vancouver, right?
Yeah, it's a lie.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. All right.
And then there are some more modern ones. Walkbox.
Oh, really? Okay. And that's funny. Like I've been to a couple Walkboxes in Edmonton, but is it a national chain now or?
Yeah. You know what? I don't know how widespread it is, but apparently it's widespread enough that it can be called a chain restaurant. But I don't know if that just means they have several locations in Edmonton and Calgary or.
Mm-hmm.
From our first location in 2004 on Jasper Ave in downtown Edmonton, Alberta, to over 60 stores today from British Columbia to Newfoundland, Walkbox continues to have something for everyone and is loved by young and old alike.
Whoa. So just the most generic, I'm just kidding.
Yeah. So Walkbox.
Okay.
And then I have another one right off the top of my head. I'm surprised. I guess I'm not super surprised that you haven't thought of it, but I know when I say it, you'll be like, oh yeah, duh. Do you want to take a crack at it?
No. I mean, no? I would love to. No, it's not coming to mind though.
Yeah, fair enough. It's Famoso Pizza.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and like Walkbox, I'm not exactly sure how widespread it is. Maybe I should Google that too.
I do remember when, we've talked about, I worked briefly at an Italian restaurant in Calgary called Mercato. And I remember that a block away from there, while I was working there, a Famoso opened. And that was kind of mind-blowing to me because, to me, Famoso was always just that place.
Downtown Edmonton.
Yeah, on Jasper. I don't know if that was the first one or not, but that's the one I knew.
That was their first location at Jasper and 116th Ave.
Oh, really? Okay, yeah.
Or 116th Street, sorry. Jasper Ave, 116th Street.
Yeah.
Ontario, Alberta, BC, and Saskatchewan. With something like a dozen or more locations, something like that. And then finally, from what I could find, according to my research. I'm sure there are actually more, but finally, Booster Juice apparently was started in Sherwood Park.
No kidding.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Like, that seems like a pretty big chain to me.
Yeah, it's...
I'm sure it's Canadian, but, like, mostly in Canada.
Oh, sorry, yeah. But. It's funny, they did a really interesting thing where, like, what used to be called the Terwilliger Recreation Center, owned by the city of Edmonton, is now called the Booster Juice Center. Did you know that?
Actually, yes, I did know that, because my niece goes there to work out, and there's, yeah, like, my brother lives near there, so yeah. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I've heard something about that recently. That's
like, I thought it was so hilarious. Ridiculous when I heard it. I was like, I'm never gonna call it that. It will always be Terwilliger. I think it's still owned by the city of Edmonton, but like, the effect that that has had on our children, because we go to swim there every couple of months, is crazy. Like, they didn't, I don't think they knew there was a Booster Juice in there. They didn't know what a Booster Juice was, but now, right, like, they call
now
it
all
the Booster
they talk
Juice
about
Center,
is Booster Juice.
And every time we go swimming, we have to get a Mango Thunder, I don't know, some silly smoothie.
I mean, it sounds delicious.
Oh yeah, it's good.
With just over 450 stores nationwide, our presence in Canada is strong. I can't tell if they have locations in the States or not, but 450 stores. Dang, that's Alan.
That's a lot of Vitamixes.
Yeah, exactly. What's nice about a Booster Juice is, yeah, all you need is like about 200 square feet in a mall and a couple of Vitamixes and you're good to go.
And a lot of freezer space probably, but...
I mean, you don't need that much freezer space.
I don't know. Aren't they blending frozen fruit?
Yeah, they are. You have to have enough freezer space, but yeah, I think you can fit it into a fairly small spot.
It's kind of like, yeah, it reminds me, like, people are always surprised if you ask people, like, you know, what restaurant has the most locations? McDonald's, you know, Burger King, Pizza Hut, or Subway. Oh, yeah. Everyone says McDonald's, right. But in most regions, the answer is Subway. Because, yeah, especially, maybe it's changed now, but like, 20 or 30 years ago, to open a Subway, like, all you needed was a sandwich table and a place to store bread. Do you know what I mean? And then you would just, yeah, buy cold cuts and cheese through the franchise and stuff. Maybe it's different now that they bake their own bread. But to open a McDonald's, like, you need a lot, way bigger footprint and way more equipment.
Yeah.
And Booster
Juice. Yeah,
juices,
I think, like, most of the information that I sort of have kicking around in my head about Subway is from when I read Fast Food Nation, I think. There's I think there's a couple sections in Fast Food Nation about Subway and sort of like the big kind of play that they made was, although you only need a small amount of space for a Subway, they bought a lot of the real estate that their locations were in.
Oh, okay.
So they made most of their money to be able to expand their business off owning like strip malls or pieces of strip malls that then other tenants would pay them rent in. And so their Subway would be like rent free and they would be earning money off charging other tenants rent. And then they could just like keep repeating that business model, mm-hmm, over and over again.
Oh, Jared, you business mastermind.
Oh, man. Yeah, there's a lot of things about Subway that are problematic. Yeah, I guess Subway isn't from Edmonton, so we have that to be thankful for.
Well,
not that I'll eat a sub from Subway. I'm not trying to act too proud, Alan. I just mean that it sounds a little bit evil to me. Yeah, so I don't know. What does that say about Edmonton? We're good at starting chains. We're good at helping them expand into the Canadian market. What is that? Is that a knock against our food culture here, or is that just lucky for us that we get to experience things that other Canadians may not wind up?
We get to eat Popeyes 3 to 6 months before anyone
before
else.
Or they
in
get
Canada.
To eat it in Winnipeg. Yeah, exactly. I don't know. This is barely a topic, honestly. I think it's interesting. I don't know if it says anything about the city. I just, you know, when we talk about food in this city a lot. I think, you know, for me, working in the service industry in this city, the feeling that I get is that independent restaurants are at like a fairly big disadvantage compared to chains. And I don't know, maybe that's true of every city, but it just feels especially true here for some reason to me. And I know that that's probably because I'm here, but I also, you know, I've been involved with a lot of independent restaurants in Edmonton, and it's a tough business to be in. And yeah, sometimes I wonder if it would be different if like the zeitgeist wasn't so focused on chains opening here. Like, you know, when a restaurant like Menu Mori opens and it's like a passion project for people that live in Edmonton and they, you know, have a deep passion for making really good ramen. I mean, they're busy right now and that's great. But they're in the space that Prairie Noodle used to be in. And Prairie Noodle is an example of like an independent Edmonton business that I don't exactly know what happened to cause it to close down. I think some of it, if I'm not mistaken, some of it had to do with COVID. I think it was around that time that it officially closed down. Mm-hmm. I could be wrong about that. Maybe they closed down before then. But it's just like, you know, they're in that space and right now they're like really busy and the quality of the food is great. And I really think that they will be successful. Like they're doing really well. But it's just like, it's a little bit scary that like they opened up last week and also two ramen chains opened here in like the right. same 6 week period. Mm-hmm. Like that's a little bit disturbing to me. And yeah, I don't know. I guess that's the point that I was trying to get to, or something that I hope that we could discuss, but it's like, it's not really, there's nothing that you can say about it, or there's nothing concrete that you can say about it. It's just more of a feeling. And I guess I was just wondering if you have the same feeling.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting kind of tension, and one that, like, having worked, I guess, pretty well exclusively for independently owned places, that was just part of the vernacular, like coming up in those kitchens was like that, like we didn't like chains. We didn't like big hospitality groups. We didn't like, because there was something, what was it like that they were sellouts or they were just stealing the good ideas from the smaller shops, but
yeah, or that they're just like printing machines with no concern for sustainability or like of the food or the people that work for them or something.
Yeah. I think yeah. I don't quite think it's black and white anymore. And I think that if anything, like when we talk about sustainability, like there's a lot to be learned from the chains about financial sustainability. And
yeah.
One of the, like, again, not black and white, but anything that the like vibrant local food service operators can learn about making operations more financially sustainable so they can keep like bringing their food and just as important their hospitality to the city. Like that's easier said than done. And I know it's like an economies of scale problem to a large degree, but I hope that like the places that do things really well, I hope they take the difficult economic decisions seriously so that they can be around and keep their brand around. To be honest, like I see it it's a lot more gray to me now than it was 15 years ago. Like I don't think that Cactus Club is evil anymore.
Right.
Or I don't think that Earl's is evil. Even though I didn't think they were very cool 15 years ago, but like I don't know. It's a complicated show.
Yeah. And I don't exactly know where you draw that line either. Right. Like you said, like, you know, what, like New Age and Village. So there's two locations of that restaurant, I think. Right. So you probably wouldn't call that a chain.
There like, were more previously.
What about, but right, yeah. And then what about something like Remedy? You know, like several locations, very popular in Edmonton. A lot of people in Edmonton are aware of it. You know, like it's, you know, like it, what is it, an independent chain? Like, I don't know. Like there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of gray area there. And I don't exactly know where you draw the line. I know you draw the line somewhere before you get to Earl's, but like, you know, like even Famoso, something with like 12 locations, like what, you know, what is that? I mean, like, you know, the, it's a national brand, I guess. So maybe that's, you know, like maybe once it escapes the province, I don't know, or escapes the city. Yeah. There's a bunch of lines to be drawn there, and I don't exactly, and those lines aren't like lines between good and evil. They're just like lines between like, you know, exposure. So yeah, I don't know. It's interesting. I just, yeah. And I guess like every city probably has its own set of concerns when it comes to the economics of owning and operating an independent restaurant. It just like, yeah, it feels like that's one of the sort of like mitigating factors in Edmonton is that like, you know, there are a lot of chains and they do consume a lot of the money that people have for dining out, and you have to like break through that wall somehow if you're an independent business. Hilarious.
But I'm you know what, Shale? Sometimes just things aren't funny. And that's, they're not going to be funny, and sometimes you just have to
sometimes you just really have to end on a downer.
Hey, listeners. You can help support Food Court and access great bonus content by joining our Patreon at patreon.com/foodcourtpod. If subscriptions aren't your thing, you can leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Food Court is recorded in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Your hosts are Alan Sutterby and Shale McDonald. Theme music by Ryan McDonald. To get new episodes on the day they're released, follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast player. We love to hear from you all. Please drop us a line at feedback@foodcourt.fm or find us on Instagram @foodcourtpodcast. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a fresh new episode. Thanks for listening.